The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
The aftermath of every social revolution brings about change. Cultural norms and landmarks shift as our minds and hearts expand beyond the familiar. To everything, there is a season and a time to every purpose in the land of the living. This is our time to renew, revive, and restore the hope lost to the busyness of life. This is our time to dig again and rebuild from the storms of our past on a solid footing that holds. Welcome to The Foundation.
The Foundation.
The Foundation is brought to you by Rowan's Electric Motors, Commonwealth Bank, Bonneville Bones, AML Foods Limited, Burger King, Fidelity Bank Bahamas, ATO's Holdings, and Alive.
Oh, so it's the Foundation. Foundation. Oh, so it's the Foundation. Foundation. Oh, so it's the Foundation.
It's the Foundation that's rocking the nation. Howard Grant's the host, got in radio station 96.9. 12 to 2 is the time. You can call the show or use the text line. Yeah, he educates, he informs. He goes against the norm. He's really got that zeal. Plus, he's a child of God.
Foundation. It's the Foundation. Foundation. It's the Foundation.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. 96.9 FM radio. Howard Grant in your company, The Foundation. On this glorious Monday morning, if you're in the land of the living, you should definitely be giving praise. I am grateful, truly grateful to be here in your presence today as we continue to be able to mourn the life of two persons snuffed out over the weekend. Just got some information this morning that one person in Eleuthera, police actually responding to the fact that one person in Eleuthera has been kind of snuffed out, and another person on Wilson Track being able to carry his daughter, preparing to carry his daughter to church yesterday morning, very early in the morning, has himself been snuffed out. We continue to be able to talk about these things, talk about where we are for growth and development, talk about where we are as a nation to be able to come to sort of a sober moment to understand that we got to be able to shift our course, shift our position, move towards growth and development, and look at these things with sobriety. I want to talk about these things and talk to you about where we are in this country right now in terms of being able to move forward. Before we do all of that, I got to give you guys a shout out. My good, decent people over there at AFS Insurance Agents and Brokers, I got to give them a shout out. They got everything available. Had a great conversation with them last week, Thursday, to talk about where they are in terms of preparation for being able to, one way or another, very subtly, being able to assist the government with its objective of being able to empower the populace. So if the government's giving SD plates, giving these particular things, then an insurance company has identified a position that they can insure you and don't have to be a heavy burden upon you, right? So you can be able to go down there and check them out at 3411AFS, 3411AFS. They'd be more than happy to assist you in those areas. So check them out, my good friend Ethric Bowe. Had breakfast with him on Saturday, over at Garden of Eden. Had a very good time. Shouts out to my good, decent friend, Ephraim Jones, down there at the Garden of Eden. If you have never been, you got to go check it out. They got the best stews in the house. Sheep tongue. Shouts out to Nancy. Nancy had some sheep tongue, said it was very good. Right, I took a little breakfast. Shouts out to Nancy. She just won the book also, The Black Crab, from Elder Adrian Edgecombe. So it's a good thing. We had a great time last week, guys. We are preparing for ourselves to do the exact same thing. This week's going to start off with a bang. And a very serious, sobering conversation, a conversation of being able to understand where we are from a midterm budget review and being able to contrast what the government has said in last year's midterm review in comparison to this year's midterm review. Make a determination as to whether or not they're moving in the direction they should be moving, or they've gone contrary, and whether they've levied a significant amount of taxation upon the backs of the Bahamian people, despite their foundational commitment to ensure that they could empower and provide opportunity for working class and lower working class and essentially poor persons in our society. Today, ladies and gentlemen, If you didn't know, if you're not a part of my group, you got to hit me up, 827-0111. I sent all the information out. We're having great conversation with none other than former, the former acting financial controller of the Bahamas. Financial secretary of the Bahamas, none other than Marlon Johnson. You see him there, right? Hold on, Howard, you can't do far. We're here having a good conversation. My brother, good afternoon to you. How are you doing today, man?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
You look rested.
Yes.
You look refreshed. Right? Yes, must not be in office right now.
No, I tell folks, you know, it was a privilege to be able to serve as acting financial secretary for 4 years, but I would be lying to say that I miss the stress and aggravation that comes with that responsibility, because it is a great responsibility. So I'm happy I had the opportunity to do it, but I can't say that I miss that part of the job, at least, the stress and aggravation.
Well, I will dive right into it. Ladies and gentlemen, after we get the base out, then I'll open up the telephone lines wide to this conversation, because I really didn't get cussed before. How would you say the phone lines open up wide? No, the conversation is confined to what we're talking about today, but I'll open up the lines right after we get the base out to talk about these things. There's a few things that I want to talk about. More specifically, I really wanted to talk about the contrast that existed here. I wanted to talk about where the government has taken us in comparison to the commitment that they've made last year. I put together a little couple of things, and I wanted to talk about, you know, let me see if I can find this now. Hold on. You see, the government of the Bahamas has done some things. More specifically, I want to do this. The last time we've heard about taxation, it would have been under the Free National Movement and the former Prime Minister, taking on this kind of a very strong position to indicate that taxation was a lazy way of being able to do that. Since then, we've only seen one level of taxation or another levied upon the Bahamian people. I want to talk to you about that before we get into the meat and potatoes of this conversation. Talk to me about this concept, whether or not taxation is an affirmed concept, an idea, an approach that the government has always been able to take, and whether or not there's any space for innovation and creativity for that to be able to look at other aspects to do some stuff.
Okay, so that's a very, very big question. I think, as I've said over and repeatedly, and I have the good fortune of being able to speak about this outside of being in government right now, or being, you know, in public service, mm-hmm. is that I do think we need to take a step back and have an honest discussion about where we are as a society and our taxes. And what I mean by that is that we have traditionally and continue to be a low tax jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Now, Bahamians hear that and they sort of lose their mind when they say that, because when they say we're low tax, they immediately think about the fact that we're a high cost destination. Mm-hmm. But our high cost and high tax aren't the same thing. We're a high cost and low tax jurisdiction. And we've been so traditionally because we've relied on just our border taxes and no direct taxes. Mm-hmm. But even after the implementation of VAT, if you compare us to any comparable country other than those who have oil revenues or the Panama Canal, you know, as a major, we are still taxed relatively low. Our VAT at 10% is on the lower range, close to the middle, but still on the lower end of sales taxes. Most places that you would go to would say anywhere between 12 and 20% of a value-added tax or a tax. And in addition, in most places with comparable development, you also have direct personal income tax. So, for example, when I lived in Belize for several years, the VAT there was 12.5%. And I had 25% tax on all of my income over $9,000 US per year. So that's more typical. And then you have to pay for garbage collection. You have, there's other taxes in there that we don't levy now. So we've been a low tax jurisdiction. So we have to start with that premise. And that's okay. But if we want to be a low tax jurisdiction, then we have to decide that, listen, we don't want the scale of government services that we typically want with, you know, subsidized education, subsidized garbage delivery, subsidized healthcare. And the like. And I think that's the national discussion we want to have. Do we really want to continue to be a low-tax jurisdiction? Can we afford to be that? And if we want to be that, then what are the implications if we want to remain a low-tax jurisdiction? Because I think we're trying to spend like we're a big-tax jurisdiction, but we're earning like we're a low-tax jurisdiction. And that's why I think our deficits and debts have been increasing.
The government has, over the past 20 years, I want to say 20 years, right. They have really been able to go to town with this concept and idea of presenting to the public that we have placed a significant emphasis on education. We've doubled the budget for education. We've done all these particular things. So the idea that there is opportunity and expansions through education exist in conversation, but in real time, we don't necessarily see that. We see the same curriculum, we see all these particular things, right? So when you start to talk about a high tax jurisdiction or being able to see this compatibility with high cost of living and then being able to see that comparison to high taxes, we need to have a deeper conversation about education.
Right.
Because if you say that you lived in Belize, the foundation of that was $9,000 they ain't taxing you. I suppose that's their working class, or that's their poorer.
So the poor person don't have to pay income tax.
The poor people don't have to pay income tax.
Right.
Right? Essentially, which you get $1,000 a month now as minimum wage,
right,
which is $12,000.
Right.
Do you think that this is a good concept to be able to look at, or should we focus more on education so we can raise everything? Talk to me about it.
So, well, there's two elements to that. I think that where the education come in is that we need to have these kinds of discussions outside of the political realm, because inevitably when we talk about deficits and debts and all of these things, it's done truly communications in the House of Assembly and by politicians. And who will have a particular bias? Because, of course, one is trying to defend themselves, the other one is trying to criticize one. So the first step, Howard, is to us to have more of these conversations outside of the political arena about what taxes ought to look like. I think that's the first step. Secondly, to your substantive point, yeah, we do need to raise education. But fundamentally, even when we do that, we still as a society have to decide what we want a government to do and not do. If we wanted the government, and what I think has been happening is that as governments go out there, we continue to expand the mandate of government. I'll give you a good example. NHI, which I thought was a brilliant, which was and is a brilliant idea. I think it's a lasting legacy of the Christie administration, Prime Minister Christie and his team. An important intervention. But it was always done with the anticipation that people would pay into it, the NHI. What it has morphed to is that we have NHI, but there's no paying into it. And that is limited. It's right now, so it's just become another extension of government payment, as opposed to a true insurance. And of course, the net effect of that is that although people now have, you know, sort of basic care, and that has been a wonderful thing, to move to full insurance, we need to have a conversation and say, no, if you're going to have insurance, you need to pay something every month. If that's $40 a month or $10 a week, and that now expands you to greater course of care, that's the cost of education. That's how it's in Singapore and in other places, and even down in Turks and Caicos, if you want to have healthcare, there's a fee you pay per month. So we keep adding expenses onto the government side, but try to tell folks that we don't have to pay for it. And again,
is that the culture?
Yeah, it's a culture because we're committed to a low tax, no tax jurisdiction, and the political competition between the parties is to say the other side taxing, taxing, taxing. So, you know, we have made taxation into a bad word. And we've made avoiding taxing into a virtue. When people talk about getting relief, it's always about I don't want to pay that tax, as opposed to I am paying the tax in order to have this service. The second side of that, though, which is equally important, is that as governments now, and I say this sincerely, I think over the next 5 to 10 years, we will have to face the prospects of more taxes if we are going to bring the debt and deficit down to an acceptable number. The question we now have to ask ourselves is, if that is the reality, then what accountability and transparency should we demand of our governments if they're going to ask us for more money? Because I think that is the legitimate critique. Every time I raise this on social media or whatnot, I have some folks who, you know, come at me hard. And their legitimate complaint is, okay, if we do need more money, then we do need to make sure that the governments, whoever's in power, open the books. We need to have freedom of information. We need to have the reports published on time. We need to have the contracts that are given out. Procurement contracts for goods and services, we need to have the summary details published. And if governments want to ask people for more money, I think it's incumbent upon us to say, well, you know, need to open the book so we could see where our money being spent and making sure we're getting value for money.
You know, I had a conversation, and I'm enjoying this already. I might as well tell you the truth. I had a conversation with one of my guests, Garth, and that one thing that continues to be able to ring in my head as I say it, because he amplified it, and I thought about it even after he said it, is that I said that everyone has a plan. Every political nation has a plan, right? Whether it's the FNM or the PLP.
Or the COI.
Or the COI. Mm-hmm. I see what you did there. Right. Or the COI, in preparation to step into government, they can now execute a plan.
Right.
Right. The only people that don't have a plan, or grouping of people that don't have a plan, is the Bahamian people. Mm-hmm. We don't have a plan. We are pliable to whatever they seek to be able to kind of upon us. Right. And we have to move with this kind of a wave.
Right.
Right. For want of a better word, no pun intended. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, I say that to say, when you start to talk about accountability and transparency, the rhythm of our culture and our society is to accept what the government places as the biblical word.
Right.
That's just what it is.
Right.
There's no way that we could be able to now, over the years, we've been accepting these things, even from the Minister of Foreign Affairs, right? And the chairman of the PLP and member of parliament for Fox Hill speak to the fact that this is traditionally a concept that has come from the other side. Right? This is an FNM concept.
Right.
We don't necessarily believe and commit ourselves to that.
Right.
The government kind of backpedaled and they tried to kind of pull those things back.
Right.
But we understand that for the most part, both administrations, mm-hmm. whether they speak to it or not,
right.
they don't seek to be able to give us accountability and transparency. This is what the government needs to do to keep the country afloat. And right. we've accepted that.
I think that's a fair critique. I think people, as a Bahamian people, I often say, you know, we're fine with what's going on until you ask us for more money. So, you know, whatever, you know, as far, and I think that's part of the change, that instead of waiting for our political leaders to change, that's where our advocacy needs to now come in collectively. We need to say that, listen, okay, I accept that we may need to, if I don't want to burden my children with all of the monies we're spending today, I may need to pay a little bit more. I've accepted that personally as a person. In my income range, I am not paying insufficient tax. And I think people who make what I make and who make more than me should be paying more. But at the same time now, if you're going to ask me for more, we need to open the books. And you hit the nail on the head. The first Freedom of Information Bill was introduced sometime, I think, in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been at this for 14 years, and we still don't have the full enactment of the Freedom of Information Act.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an indictment on successive administrations. Mm-hmm. They pay lip service in opposition. And when they get into power, they all of a sudden now realize, you know, this is not a priority, it's not such a good idea. And by and large, Bahamians have accepted that. So, you know, we got to look at us. You know, there's legislation that require, the Procurement Act, that all contracts, the summary details ought to be published within 60 days of awarding the contract. That still hasn't been fully implemented for reasons that I cannot fathom. And again, it isn't a critique at the current administration, because the former administration wasn't much better in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
The law didn't exist at the time, but certainly there was no rush to do these things. So it falls back on us. It falls back on us to say, listen, as a people, when we now looking at our elects, let's collectively, every time the MP show up at the door, ask them the question, where are you with freedom of information? Where are you with the publication and the like? If we're not interested in these things, we can't expect the policymakers to be interested. And let's not wait until they come and knock on the door or introduce in the House a new tax for us to start making noise. Let's say reasonably, as that happens in other jurisdictions, we want the books to be open. And we want it as a matter of course, and not as a political thing, or not as a partisan thing, but just as a element for. And I keep telling folks, let's ask for it. Politicians will respond to what we ask for. But if we're asking for narrow little things to sort ourselves out, then we don't want to get in. And I always take the adage that has been said. You want a government that's sitting to pass laws that you could be comfortable with when your party isn't in power.
Mm-hmm.
And so it ain't just to say, okay, we're comfortable now because our boy's in. But we want them to pass legislation because inevitably governments are going to change. And we want to make sure that whomever's in, we have access to know how our money is being spent. And I think that has to be something that we have to say. It's reasonable. It doesn't take much change, but it takes us deciding that that's what we want done.
This accountability concept and idea that comes to the forefront every time we start to have this conversation and governments seek to kind of introduce a new tax on the people, when we start to talk about accountability and transparency, for the most part, except me, Howard Grant, I thought that the former administration, call me naive, the former administration with the concept and idea of a delivery unit, with the concept and idea of being able to create built-in transparency and elements of accountability, whether it be the delivery unit, whether it be the secretary in the office of the prime minister, so forth and so on, that it could have led to a sense of transparency even as they prepare themselves to move to the Freedom of Information Act. That has not happened at all.
Well, no, I think, no, the current government has the delivery unit, and I think they are, I mean, they're constituted and they are moving to try to focus in on delivering the government's policies. The current government also, in its own iterations of the Public Procurement Act 2023 and the Public Financial Management Act, did have embedded in it a lot of the transparency and accountability mechanisms. They didn't take a lot of that out or remove those elements. Where we fall short, and again, this isn't just this administration or the former one, but let's go back several administrations. The easiest example that I always point on is the state-owned enterprises. We have over 50 state-owned enterprises in a country of 400,000 people. That's a lot. That's all of the commissions, authorities, and the like. And almost all of them are required every year to produce annual statements. How often do we see those? Those are supposed to be published. Whether that's UB, whether it's the PHA, whether it's Bahamas Air, NIB, those entities are required by law to publish annual statements. And most of them are years and years and years behind. So we, as taxpayers...
Is it by design or is it just incompetence that exists in these spaces?
The whatever the reasons, Howard... It isn't happening. The law is not being adhered to.
And so, I appreciate you.
Right, and so the truth of the matter is, whatever the reasons may be, we have to be insistent as Bahamians that, listen, if my tax dollars is funding these entities to the tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars every year, it's only reasonable that me, as the owner of the enterprise, you know, we as taxpayers, get a chance to see the audited reports.
I got a two-part question for you. First... There was an expectancy from all of us who know you personally to incrementally create the framework, at least to introduce these concepts and ideas that exist for whenever this inevitability of government happens, this change could happen. They had this kind of a framework that if they don't stop, review, and cancel, we have the proper framework to execute. One. Secondly, I want to be able to talk about this kind of a concept that exists in this space. When we start to talk about these things, the fact of the matter is that we know one thing. The Maslow's hierarchy of needs starts to talk to us about the only way that we can get to the pinnacle is if we have the foundation, if we have the base. If we could feed ourselves, if we could take care of ourselves, and these basic comforts and necessities are taken care of, we don't have that in society. We don't have this basic stuff in society. There's still persons scrambling to find out how they're going to be able to work. They're trying to figure out what they can offer. Do you believe in one way or another, not necessarily from an official government capacity, but do you believe that there is some thinking enshrined in how we enact our laws and execute these particular things is that we take advantage of the vulnerability of our people as opposed to being able to be up above board and very transparent?
No, I don't think it's that cynical. I really don't. So let me take let me take your first question first about leaving in place the mechanisms. We have to understand that whatever happens at the public service, the public servants are creatures of instructions. So it's the policymakers that are the ones who would put in place policies for continuity. One of the things that started again in the Christie administration that's being picked up now is the National Development Plan. And I would like to see that brought back and recast, not as a something that a government does, but something that a society does. Let's take a look at that, but let's now really engage civil society. Let's engage the opposition, the government, the business community. And let's, if we're going to come up with a national development plan that will mitigate against some of this stop, delay, and cancel, it has to be something that all stakeholders have a party to and buy into and move forward. Because if it's seen as coming from just the narrow political directorate, it will be their thing and not everybody's thing. So that's to answer your first question as to how we sort of have continuity on major initiatives. On the second part, one of the great successes of successive administrations have been that we have continued to expand the social welfare net. You know, tens of millions of dollars are spent every year in ensuring... Now, the system don't work perfectly, and there are people who fall through the crack. But if you compare Bahamas to every other places, people can get assistance. They can get food. They can get access to shelter. They, I mean, you know, appliances sometimes, you know, people who roofs have blown off. The government has stepped in. So successive administrations, including the current one, devote tremendous resources in helping the vulnerable. So I don't get the sense that it's a there's sort of some deliberate attempt to contain the vulnerable. I think we have done a good job as a society of providing support and assistance to the vulnerable.
Just enough.
No, but I mean, it could be improved, sure. But again, if we want to have a expanded welfare state, then now we're going to come back to say, well, do we wish to pay for it? Because that's the other side of that coin. But people in the Bahamas don't go hungry. Most people have some place to stay. People have free education. They get free health care. So the government now, BTVI is free. UB is free. There are grants given to people in underprivileged areas to be able to start their own business. So I would argue that we have been moving in the right direction broadly with that. Could it be done more? Yeah. But I think we have done a fairly good job as a society on that. That's my view on it.
I like this conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, you got to be able to join me. When we get back, we can start to talk about the midterm budget review, the position that the government is right now. We're going to talk about sort of the SWOT analysis, the strengths, the weaknesses, the opportunities, and the threats that exist in that particular space, and what our expectations are as we move forward with this administration. We're here talking with none other than Marlon Johnson, being able to chop this thing down. Take this quick commercial break and be right back after this.
The Foundation.
Make your mornings easy with the new breakfast bowls at Burger King Nassau. These delicious bowls are a complete breakfast in a convenient package for those on the run who want to enjoy the most important meal of the day, the BK way. Each breakfast bowl has all the breakfast fixings you love and comes in three tasty versions to choose from, including the classic, the Southwestern style, and the keto-friendly bowl. BK just made breakfast easier with the new breakfast bowls at Burger King Nassau, where taste is king.
Struggling to repay your loan? Let us help you get back on track with payment terms that suits your financial situation and improve your credit score and credit report with the Bahamas Credit Bureau. Inquire about our restructured loans today. Call us at 356-7764.
Calling all pizza lovers. Craving something extraordinary? Head into Marco's Pizza and try our golden crust deep dish pizza, made thick and delicious with fresh dough, fresh cheese, and fresh sauce, and baked to perfection with your toppings of choice. No one makes pizza quite as good as we do. Enjoy all this goodness for $14.75 only at Marco's Pizza. Make the right choice and order Marco's at marcospizzabahamas.com.
Creativity is in my blood. From shoes to handbags, fashion lets me express myself and embody Bahamian culture. My name is Aiden Barrow, and I'm the creative director of House of Assembly. A Lives Liberty Prime plan allows me to focus on my passion and stay connected, whether at home or abroad. Once I've created something new, I can post to social media from anywhere and get instant feedback. Alive has a plan for everyone, and it's created with you in mind. Alive. Believe in best.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Foundation. The Foundation.
And we are back, ladies and gentlemen, 96.9 FM Radio. Howard Grant in your company, speaking with none other than Marlon Johnson, being able to chop down the midterm budget review all the way from the House of Assembly, being able to talk about what our expectations are in terms of moving forward. Marlon, when we left off, we started to talk about these things. I wanted to talk about SWOT analysis. I want to take that there. I want to ask you, first off, what did you make of this position? What do you make of being able to identify the position? Now, we know that there has been a relentless comparison between, Simon Wilson and Marlon Johnson, even when you sat in that position, what he would have done, what he wouldn't have done, so forth and so on. For the most part, whether you say this or not, for the most part, we have socially been able to see a shift. Right, a lot of people are saying, "Well, I didn't expect this," and it seems as though This administration has taken on that kind of a very stringent, stiff-neck approach that the Free National Movement has taken, that we need to do this for the growth and development of the country. So it seems as though this administration has taken, because, you know, before, if I can say this, before they were more pliable, they were more pandering to, you know, a particular segment or their grouping. But now it seems very above board. We need to create revenue for the government of the Bahamas. Tell me what you made of the midterm budget review and give me some SWOT analysis as it as relates to what was strong, what you think was weaker, what the opportunities that they've missed, and where there could be sort of impending threats. Talk to me about it.
So I think the current administration has sort of picked up where, you know, both previous administrations, the Christie one and the Minnis administration, left off, recognizing that there need to be more attention on revenue collection.
Mm-hmm.
The government was very, very clear from that from day one. Remember, because they have a policy commitment to get our, and I don't want to get too technical to just get people sort of thinking, but the policy aim was to increase our revenue from around 18-19% revenue to GDP to 25%. That's a stated policy aim.
Mm-hmm.
And under that, documented and published, was the what's called enhanced revenue collection,
mm-hmm.
meaning that to get delinquent folks back in, and make sure that people who weren't paying were paying. So what you see from the current administration, what you see from the financial secretary and his team, is them giving life to the government's policy aim, and that is to crack down on tax cheats and to ensure that persons, delinquent payers, are paying up. That's a specific policy effort, and they have done a great job as far as I can see on that count. You know, it is stringent. It can be tough. But this is going after people who haven't been paying.
But this isn't foreign. I think it was the Christie administration who introduced the
revenue enhancement team.
The revenue enhancement team,
right? And yeah. Again, it was continued under the Minnis administration, and now being again continued under the current.
But listen, this country is a dangerous thing. When they introduced that, I said, "Oh, they can do that. They can do that with that." And then when you saw them actually require,
right.
You being able to come up and being able to have a conversation with us, I said, okay, globally, we're shifting.
Right, but I just wanted to make sure everybody understand. Although it may be more open now, it isn't just new. That's been a continuation of going all the way back to the Christie administration. What is probably now more different is that the level's a lot more public. But I can tell you there was a lot of hard conversations in the DIR and myself when I was in the chair, talking to delinquent taxpayers and bringing it forward. So there was some success. Again, to the credit of the current administration, it is a lot more open, it's a lot more focused. But that's, again, that isn't necessarily just the Ministry of Finance doing this. It's a specific and documented policy objective of the government to crack down on tax cheats.
The government, despite the fact that you're red, despite the fact that you're yellow, when you sit in this particular position, there is an objective.
Right. Yeah. So, public servants can only move within the context of the law and the policy directives of the government.
Yeah.
So, I used to get beat up for a lot of things that happened in the last administration. I always had to remind folks that my job was to execute the policy and make recommendations, but it's the policymakers, the elected officials, who make the decisions as to what happens, not the public servants, not on policy issues. So that's a policy focus of the government. The DIR has done a great job, I think, the Ministry of Finance as well. The challenge will always be, when you go after people who owe money, as you know this, you know, anybody in business knows this, there could be some who have the money and just refusing to pay. That's your low-hanging fruit. Because you could go after them, and once you start to...
How do you differentiate between the ones who have and don't have?
No, I mean, because remember now, the government has the power to pause your bank account, to garnish your bank account. So it's you can... And when you start to press people and you threaten them legally, you know who then have the money, who don't.
They show up right away.
Because, yeah, those who have the money... It's like, you know, it's like the people who... I'm sure you all know people who will let their light bill... Bill up, and as soon as BPL announced the
$8 million,
right? They rush in, and they pay the full $5,000 they owe. So this is that they didn't have the money, but not until you wave the stick are they going to come in to pay. So there are some taxpayers like that. The more challenging ones, once you run out of that group of people, they are the challenging people of people who owe the money but don't spend the money, and so now that is where you see the government now moving in this discussion about liquidating properties. Because you could come to me and if I owe you, you know, again, we all know this in our personal life. If somebody owe you $300, you could berate them and take them to court and that, but if they don't have the $300, they don't have it. And so
point blank.
You have to work with them and they can pay you $10 a week until they pay the $300 off.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still worthwhile doing, but you don't get that revenue yield that you once have once you pick all the low-hanging fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, once the government has sort of exhausted all of the low-hanging fruit, yeah, you still have to go after the tax delinquent, but your revenue impact immediately is going to be a lot slower there. So I think, I say all that to say that at some point, you're going to squeeze that fruit as hard as you can. And then if that doesn't yield and we're still spending the money at the pace we have, we will have at some point to look at additional revenue measures to close the gap. So part of the discussion we need to have is what we want to do on the spending side. Because if you grow in the spending side, you're going to have to continue to grow the revenue side. But if there's ways to contain spending, then that limits the new revenue growth that you...
So talk to me about it. Talk to me about what you made in your professional capacity, being able to sit in the seat and being able to assess everything.
Right.
What did you make, good, bad, ugly, indifferent, of this budget review and sort of the SWOT analysis?
So I think, generally speaking, the country and the finances are trending in the right direction. We have been extremely fortunate as a country to rebound as quickly and as robustly as we have following the pandemic. There are still some behemoths who only think the pandemic happened to us, that we were the only ones who sort of shut things down and everybody else was living their life. No, the world shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we faced as far as, you know, the curfews and the like was being replicated. North America, it varied by state. But if you take out the U.S., most of the places had similar experiences. Not exact, but similar as far as curfews and lockdowns and the like. And economies shutting down. I think in our wildest dreams, nobody would have expected us to rebound as quickly as we had. And that happened simply because there was a lot of pent-up demand for travel. The current administration came in. They did the right things in you know, facilitating the opening of the economy and doing the things that needed to be happening, promoting the Bahamas out there as a place that's open. And so we have rebounded really, really well. Our unemployment... like other places in the region, is probably at a historical low. The last measure was under 10%, but I think, you know, if we were measured now, we're probably close to 7% unemployment. And you see it because even in entry-level positions, you see people advertising, looking for people. So we are doing pretty well. I mean, we have a tendency of thinking the world always falling down, but I think by and large, the country economically has rebounded well.
You think it's 7%?
Unemployment. That's just my hazard, my guess. I think we're probably at historically low unemployment rate.
The closest that we've seen in the past two decades was 9%.
9%. I think we down. If you look at Jamaica's now.
That's under, wild what you're saying. 7%.
I would hazard a guess at the time we do this again, it could probably be close to 7%. I think we're close to full employment. The economy is doing remarkably well, especially considering all the things that has transpired. It's folly to try to deny that. I mean, you know, now again, I want to be careful because when I say that, people always go, things ain't good for me. And no, I understand that. When I say this in a very broad, general sort of way.
Because I'm about to tell you right now, this a great deal of this this growth that we've seen from employment standpoint has to do with this position that people have taken. The hotel shut down. Right now, you can actually see the sea where there was actually a hotel in the person of Malia, formerly the Sheraton in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is that the persons who were in this space that sat down for years, that mulled over, what am I going to do? How am I going to make these things happen?
Mm-hmm.
Tapped into their skill set and started to make money. So now we see more entrepreneurs.
Of course.
We see more entrepreneurs mm-hmm. who are now saying, wow, I get in so much business, I could take on two people. And so this lends to another question I want to talk to you about,
right.
The middle class.
Right.
The middle class and simultaneously having a conversation about not only the middle class, but these enterprises that are building and not getting the type of support. Now, I know you can tell me about the SBDC.
Mm-hmm.
I know you can tell me about these particular concepts that has come down from the ID, the World Bank and what they've done, the IDB, so mm-hmm. forth and right. so on. But historically, right. government has not necessarily been able to identify and amplify the right. support for those persons.
Right.
A lot of persons, take for instance, under the former administration.
Right.
Take for instance, Airbnb.
Right.
right? When persons had to chop piece of their own house off,
right,
their abode, and create a space so they can be able to make a subsequent income to be able to survive.
Right.
The government sought to tax this for the purposes of whatever y'all look at and say, oh my God, we're making money. Let's see if we can be able to garner this.
Right.
So talk to me about that. The government has yet to be able to really support persons who are really being able to put themselves out there for businesses. Do you think that they've missed an opportunity with this?
So again, let's look historically as to what happened. Over the last... You know, prior to the SBDC coming on stream, they had the Bahamas Development Bank, BIC, and the like. Over the last sort of 5 years, I think the last numbers we've probably been able to provide about somewhere between $60, $65 million in financing directly to small businesses. Where prior to that, it was just a trickle. Now, some of that was pandemic money, special loans, and the like. But even now with the SBDC, you see daily them being able to provide both grants and loans to small business. So, yeah, you're right. It's probably not enough, but it's a lot more than what was there before. So it's trending in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
If you talk to the people at the SBDC, one of the things they have been working hard to do, though, is getting people with good ideas to put together a proper plan and a proper infrastructure. Because, you know, there are people like me and you who have grandiose ideas. I want to open up, you know...
Don't tell us, because somebody can teach it.
Yeah, no, I open up a small boutique hotel in somewhere, and I like the dream, and the like.
Me too.
But I don't have that expertise. So when people come into the SBDC, part of the challenge is saying, listen, you got to creep before you could walk. And you got to put a proper infrastructure and the like so that we can go and get you the financing that we need. So, you know, it isn't where it needs to be. And we could do a whole other show as to some of the things we can do better to enable people to get into business, to help people access financing and the like. But I think the last administration, the current administration, have been taking very, very deliberate steps to expand, to get money in the hands of people who want to get into business and open up a business. But back to the discussion we were having before we get to that about the broadness of the economy. I think what we have to now look at is that now that the economy has reflated, you know, now that we've gotten back to 2019 and even more as far as the economic growth, if you look at the trend line going forward, you see that the Bahamas is going to trend right back down to the low growth, sub 2% real growth every year. And so...
After which inflection point?
After
26?
Yeah, after 24.
After 24.
If you look at the
government... So next year...
It's going to 1.5% growth, 1.1% growth. And that's actually in the midterm budget book. You'll see that we're trending back to, this is by the government's own admission, and it's the same thing that the IMF and the World Bank have said.
Yeah, this is global forecast.
Right, yeah, but for us, other countries, the Caribbean average, we're scheduled, I'll give you a good example. The World Bank has said that this year, 2024, we're going to grow by 1.8%. That isn't bad, but that isn't, you know, that isn't big growth either. That's what we'll call just moderate, healthy growth. The Caribbean average, out taking Guyana, which is growing by 30% because of oil. So even if you take them out, the Caribbean average is 4% economic growth. So we're not growing as fast as the regional average.
We're behind like 2.7%.
From the average. Yes. So there are others, of course, who are higher than that. And so if we want to escape the what we call the debt trap. If we want to be able to grow ourselves out of our current debt and deficit position without substantial new taxes, it will mean that we have to get the economy turbocharged. So one of the things...
But turbocharge is the introduction of new industry, right?
Or get more people, get more greater capital formation, doing the things that is going to get that economic growth higher. It don't have to be new industries, Howard, because we haven't begun to exploit our current industry yet. Tourism... If you think about it, the vast majority of the Bahamian islands are underdeveloped or undeveloped. There are beaches out there where crabs dying on the beach from old age, right? And so before we even talk about new industries, we haven't fully exploited the current industry.
But Marlon, but we can't have a conversation about exploitation of the industries that exist without being able to look at the very clear reality of survivability. One, when you start to have a conversation about $60 to $65 million injected into small and medium businesses, mm-hmm. and then you start to talk about the transition it'll take for persons, the government has to be deliberate. deliberate with identifying these things and exponentially increase this for people to even move.
Right.
And ensure that places like Andres, the places like, let's say, Andres, Eleuthera, San Salvador, Abaco, has the proper infrastructure for me to even take my family there.
Right.
Because I can't, so I can't commute.
Yeah, but let's flip it on. We can always talk about, and I will support the notion that governments could do more. But let's put the onus back on ourselves, Howard. Let's look at, so I'll give you a good right example is South Eleuthera, just by way of example. The Disney project is coming there. All right? There's going to be ample opportunities in Grand Bahama. We have all the infrastructure. You're going to have Carnival with the cruise port coming there and a new airport that will certainly be on the way. I often ask my peers this. If 10 of us, 20 of us, 100 of us, mobilize ourselves and we are going to decide that, listen, we are going to put some money together as a consortium of folks and we go to the government with idea that's sensible, and we got the expertise, I assure you the government will back it.
Oh,
and
that's, my God.
And I can assure you the current government will back it. I can assure you the previous one would have because others have done it. There are Bahamians out there who are opening up, condos and selling Airbnbs, who are doing boutique hotels. There are Bahamians out there making it happen. So the question we got to ask is, even as we agitate government to do the things to enable it, I think we also have to look at ourselves and think about how we can pool our resources together and make things happen. That is part of the self-reflection we need to do. Because between us, we have the money and the expertise to go make some things happen.
I like this. Let me take the telephone call before they cuss me out. Caller on the line with us live. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Grant. How you doing?
I'm good, my brother. How you doing?
All right. And good afternoon to your guest.
Hi, good afternoon.
I heard your guest, say something about there are government agencies that are failing to present annual reports or something like that.
You know, I'm making the point that the state-owned enterprises, that's all the authorities and commissions, they, by law, are required to do annual audits, and most of them are behind.
Yeah. My question is that you said they are failing to do so.
Right.
I feel as if, like individuals like yourself who know things like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if we were true patriots and true individuals who, stood for law and order, right?
Right.
That you see how you talk about getting the funds together and putting it to the government for some kind of plan that the government could approve, right?
Right.
I feel as if that you, with that knowledge of the failure of the government, you could get together individuals like-minded like yourself and you could, make that stop. Demand that they do, that what they are... constitutionally, supposed to do.
Yeah.
Right? You know what I mean? Because I don't understand how come individuals could sit back knowingly, knowing that these things are knowingly happen, right? And refuse and just talk about it. I mean, I understand that. But man, what I want to say is that in a world of experts, like we have so many experts at this, experts at that, but yet still the world is in as if it's being run by novices. You know what I mean? How is it that we can't find true solutions to problems that face us? I mean, with all these individuals, with all this knowledge and all this education, right? And what I want to know, too, is that when you were talking about the government was, planning on, cracking down on people who duck in paying taxes, my question, what areas are these individuals and what industries are these in? Because whenever I hear the government starting to talk about increasing government revenue, I know that the way the government gets most of its revenue is through taxing.
Right.
And they the people who they tax the most is us.
Right.
So whenever I hear them talk about increasing government revenue, I become a bit concerned.
Right.
What I want to know is, what areas do you see government targeting for these tax duckers, right?
Okay.
And why is it that, because I've heard over and over again, I think even one time Jeff Lloyd was on, one time he had a talk show before he went into government, and he was talking about, he had a particular foreign client who had made, a ridiculous amount of money, and that the client asked him how much tax he had to pay, and he told the client nothing, and he said the client was shocked. So, I mean, I want to know why is it that our government does not target companies and foreign multinational organizations or whoever do business down here that make a ridiculous amount of money. Why don't we tax them? I mean, I want to know if they're included in this tax ducking thing. If you understand?
Okay.
Yes, so thank you very much.
Thank you, brother. I do appreciate you. When we get back, we're going to deal with those particular things. When we get back, I want to talk with Marlon Johnson about the EU blacklisting, public-private partnership, crowdfunding, the concept and idea that exists in Grand Ducayan, this idea that he's put on the table about persons being able to come together, because I'm sure that would have been crowdfunding and being able to do those things like that. And then I want to talk to you more specifically about your position. You started to talk about advocacy, and then you said that in a world of experts, that we're ruled by novices. I want to talk about that. We're going to have a good conversation when we get back, guys. The line's going to be wide open. For the purposes of this conversation, don't fight me. 96.9 FM Radio, Howard Grant, the Foundation. Quick commercial break, get to news, and be right back after this.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.
Foundation. The foundation.
And we are back, ladies and gentlemen, 96.9 FM Radio, Howard Grant in your company, The Foundation, on this beautiful Monday afternoon, live and in full effect, always being able to chop it down, being able to bring you the realest of conversations with transparency. I know you want to talk about these things. I think the rhythm of how we've taken this kind of a deduction and how we've deduced budget reviews, how we've deduced midterm reports, so forth and so on, has always been with the rhythm of how it's the speech, right?
Right.
But we have to kind of give it to the contrast of the necessity of society and the ability for the government to make the right decisions to empower, employ, and execute for growth of society. I think that that's what we're doing today. And I'm sitting with none other than Marlon Johnson, being able to talk about these things. I'm grateful to be here with him. Marlon, when we left off, the gentleman called in and started to talk about advocacy from experts. So talk to that. He started to talk about this kind of an idea that says, why don't we hear more from experts such as yourself? Why don't y'all get together and put fire to the government for the positions that they've taken and transparency, because you guys know.
Right.
Why don't you say something? Talk to me about it.
Well, you know, the good news for him is that there are organizations. One of them is called ORG, Organization for Responsible Governance, which is a nonpartisan advocacy organization that has been around for some while. So if he and others are interested in how they can help spread the word about getting, you know, more openness and honesty and accountability in government, there are organizations like ORG that he can Google. It's called Organization for Responsible Governance, and be a party to it. But it isn't going to be just so, because these conversations do happen and are happening. I want to encourage everybody even if you don't get the newspapers physically, all of the newspapers publish their stories online, and they publish them on Facebook and other social media platforms. So these things have been talked about and are talked about routinely, about the things that are happening good, things that are happening bad, the things that are questionable. But we have to individually commit to say, I could spend a half hour a day just reading the front pages of the newspapers and the front pages of the business section and getting an understanding of what's going on. We just can't spend our days, just hearing voice notes and scrolling through social media to get an understanding of it. It ain't gonna happen. And you can't leave it to just the experts. You know, now that he's been made aware, he now has a responsibility, like we all do, of saying, which organizations or groupings can I align myself with to help do it? And something that we all could do. Every now and again, we interact with policymakers. Our MPs, aspiring MPs, ministers. When we talk to them, of course, you're going to talk about your own personal issue, but show them that you have an interest in these things. Tell them that you want the full implementation of Freedom of Information Act. Tell them you want to see these things done. If we, politicians all over the world, are going to respond to what their citizens demand of them. So don't wait for the experts to advocate. We all can become experts, and if we demonstrate that these things matter to us, then it's going to matter to them. But as long as the only thing we're worried about is, listen, I need, you know, when a couple of dollars, I need a job for my people. As long as our interests are only for the things that we immediately need, they're going to respond to that. So we need to have both, and nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with advocating for your own personal needs. But so that's my challenge to all your listeners. Make this a point of discussion with all politicians who come to your door.
It's crazy that the gentleman structured it like this, because it seems like an us and a them.
Right.
It seems like there is a line that is drawn between the intellectually adept persons in our society and those of us who are on the other side of that line just seeking survivability. And he's saying, what I gather from what he's saying is that, yeah, a lot of us are concerned with just survivability, but there are some other persons that we need and we depend on who are in a more educated, who are in a more comfortable position socially, who've done more that we need to hear from you. For the most part, in our society, what we see is those persons are kind of, locked behind their doors, their walls, so forth and so on. How do we now become this society that we can all, and I agree with you, I believe that we have the responsibility for being able to do introspection, to understand our responsibility and contribution, no matter the part of the tier. Right. Whether you're on the top tier, middle or lower tier, all of us have a contribution to this cake that is economy.
Right. Let me give you a good, simple example. When I was a small businessman probably about 20 years ago, and one of my good friends, Johnny Outen, had the idea of getting going, the Small Business Association of the Bahamas going. And he and I and several others, We got the Small Business Association going. We eventually tethered it to the Chamber of Commerce, and it didn't last very long, but it did last for several years with interested small business owners. And people had been for years advocating, saying that we need to have funding mechanisms for small businesses. And after we had several meetings, we found out what people want. We put pen to paper. And we asked then Prime Minister Christie if we can get an entrepreneurial venture fund going.
This is between 2 and 7.
Yeah, this is between 2 and 7. And that led to the formation of the Bahamas Entrepreneurial Venture Fund, which still is going and which has funded any number of small Bahamian businesses. But what was surprising to us was that the willingness of the government to listen to us, because we were organized and we put together something that was working.
This is the second time you say this, or third.
Right. But I'm making a point. I'm making a deliberate point. We talk and, you know, we have the talking heads and we scream, organize advocacy. And I could give you several other examples where different administrations, PLP and FNM, have responded positively to those persons who organize themselves, who advocate in an organized way, and who put together communications that make sense. I've seen it happen, certainly when I was FS, with persons who approached the government at the time. In the Christie administration, I saw it, and I get the sense that Prime Minister Davis is the very same way, that if you come to him with organized and coherent plans or ideas, you will get an audience. You may not always get the answer you want, but that's my challenge. Let's just stop screaming at the darkness. You know, we got to organize the way that we critique. And we got to demonstrate that this is what we want to see done, and this is how we get done. Because it works. The advocacy, organized advocacy works.
Tell me this. What is the fare for, what have you seen historically, traditionally, culturally, as the fare of organizing and putting together a coherent thought and presenting that to the government of the Bahamas?
So
any government?
I think people have an unreasonable fear that if they put together something that the government may not be interested in, that they're going to automatically be blacklisted. And the governments go to parliament, they back and forth. They understand that not everybody is in support of this. But if you can advocate in a nonpartisan way, and that you're not coming to try to embarrass a government or to try to just score political brownie points, you will get any sitting government of the Bahamas to listen to you. But you got to take, and the other thing is, we don't want to do the work. Someone got to sit down and put it together and be willing to lead the effort and get it done. So now, political advocacy is important. So I don't want to downplay those people who want to agitate politically. But there's another way that we can advocate a civil society.
This economic advocation that we're talking about, this economic advocation, historically there's always been this view. You started to talk about the fact that you desire to open up a boutique hotel. And there are a lot of persons that are talking about the concepts and ideas of being able to create industry, create opportunities for themselves, right, and empower the people around them. But right, there has been stories,
right,
very dark stories,
yeah,
about this presentation, right, to the protocol of government. Not right, necessarily just showing up to cabinet one day, but right, there is a protocol,
right,
that you follow in doing these things. And the fear, and the stories that come back from this is that I presented this to the first tier,
right,
and these people teach my idea.
Right.
My God.
Right.
That is that a reasonable fear?
I'm sure there is no place in the world where somebody hasn't presented an idea and someone with the means has taken it and run with it. There's no way to guard against that, right? But what you do, if you realize that's a reasonable fear, that means you got to mobilize a lot more on the front end. You know, in other words, you got to have your ducks lined up and ready to go. The wonderful thing for those who may be interested in getting the hospitality industry is that right now, I think back in 2021 was the last numbers I saw. We had, I think, the number was somewhere around 8,000 listed or 4,000 listed Airbnb properties in the Bahamas. That's just for the sake of argument, say that half of them are owned by foreign second home. That's still 2,000 Bahamians who have an Airbnb property. That number would have certainly gone up by now. And those of you who search around Airbnb know that there's Airbnbs in Grantstown, in Pinewood,
Which is all scary. I just
want right, to right. But the point I am making is that ordinary Bahamians are getting into the hospitality space. There are people, Bahamians, while again, out of them screaming that they don't have no opportunities, who saying, listen, me and my brothers or me and my friends, we're going to put up and get a little addition onto somebody's house or get a cottage going somewhere, and they are making it happen. You don't hear these people complaining and making noise. They go through the same frustrations. They get the door slammed in their face and the like, but they persevere. So you can spend a lot of time cursing the darkness, or you could light a candle. And more of those behaviors, and you can't do it individually. We know there are groups, just to avoid any charges of racism, we know there are groups who come into the country from the Far East, generally speaking, penniless. And they do this in every country, and they don't get the government to give them a penny, but they all end up self-sufficient and often wealthy.
Marlon.
Right? So the point I am making there is that if people can come to your shores, right, and I'm not talking about our Haitian and Caribbean migrants, but I'm talking about
the Far East.
The Far East, right?
China.
Yeah, right? If and they not only do this in the Bahamas, but wherever they go, again, sometimes facing, not they don't face persecution here, but in other places they face the persecution. And if they could work together to be self-sufficient and become wealthy, then why are we waiting for Superman? Why are we waiting for somebody to kick down the door for us? So let's, and again, that don't mean we give the governments a pass for the things they're not doing. But we cannot focus our entirety of our attention on waiting for somebody to do it for us.
I got to talk to you about that, but we got a couple of telephone calls. Lines are wide open, guys. If you want to be able to participate in this conversation, I'd love to have you. 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. Anywhere for the Family of Islands, 242-300-5720, or hit me up, 422-4796. That's on the text line. Let me get this call. A call on the line with us live. Go ahead.
Mr. Grant.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm your guest.
Hi, good afternoon.
I don't know. Would I be broken your protocol if I don't touch on homicide or what?
We ain't talking about homicide today. We're talking about the economy. We're here sitting with none other than Marlon Johnson.
Oh, that's Mr. Johnson. Okay,
yes,
good.
Yes.
Yeah, happy New Year to Mr. Johnson.
All right, good.
Yes. Okay. All right, thanks.
Now, if you hold that question, we have an opportunity to be able to talk about that tomorrow, God spare, because I'd like to be able to talk about that. So let me take the next caller. Caller on the line with us live. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good afternoon, Mr. Howard.
Hey, what's up, 52?
Good afternoon to Mr. Marlon Johnson.
Good afternoon.
I love what he's saying, right? But I was taken aback by a few things that he said in the first hour. So I kind of disagree with him because as an average person and a small business runner of a family business, right, I spend a lot of money on VAT. I send people to various places to spend money because of my labor, right? And I go and buy the materials for them sometime, and then personal consumption, goods, et cetera, I spend a lot of money sometimes, and I pay what? So, I mean, I'm looking at me as one person and what I'm doing. I don't know what people, water is a consumption tax. If you go to water and sewage, there's a tax there.
Right.
The BTC, there's a tax there. And I have children, so I have to keep spending money.
Right.
So I spend like a couple hundred dollars a day.
Right.
Just on, I don't even know how much money I spend at the grocery because I don't even check.
Right.
I buy expensive food, and even though they're still poisoning me. But what I'm offended by is you saying, of course, I understand it was a broad thing when you said it's a low tax district. And I agree with that. But
right.
What I'm saying is the government is not taking into account the effects of VAT, the consumption tax, on people, even though. But see, the thing is, I don't even mind paying the tax if we had a real like a healthcare, like I see the money being spent wisely. But then what I'm saying is, I mean, really and truly, because me at my age, at 60 in a few months,
right.
I don't feel I'm getting anything for what I'm putting in. And
right.
Here you talking about money for garbage collection. Listen to me. The amount of money what I spend on what is unbelievable for a poor man. So I know they're affecting me because, like, I went to the store, you go there, you spend this amount of money. When you look, you see what's what, you go to get something to
right.
I'm always in and out of a business.
Right.
I'm always spending money.
Right.
I don't see the reciprocity.
Right.
So then I'm upset that it's being dubbed as a low tax. The government is not taking this.
So I understand the point. I understand the point.
I have a question before
sure.
I go. You said embarrassing the government as far as getting them to, you mentioned org and all of that. And the government.
Yeah, I didn't say we ought to embarrass the government.
Embarrass citizens too.
Right, right.
Like for me, right?
Right?
An embarrassment for me is them wasting the taxpayers' money.
Right.
And Joe Biden taking, let's say Joe Biden taking the taxpayers' money in New York and giving migrants stipends, okay?
Right.
And now the government flying over to Rome to see the Pope.
Right.
And I wonder if they know the history of Rome.
Right.
And why, are we that stain that we can't, is this a democracy?
Right.
What are we doing? We can't break loose of nothing.
Right.
And org is toothless.
Right.
What, you know, the government wouldn't take us serious unless we see 20 or 30,000 people in the front of the South of Assembly in anger. That's the way I feel.
I got you. No, no.
My God, I appreciate you.
He
gone.
You know, and again, I'm happy that he called and expressed, because this is what we need. We don't all got to agree. We don't, but we need people to, we need to continue these conversations and have the varying perspectives. He mentioned paying a lot for VAT. Anybody who's lived abroad, again, outside of the U.S., understands what a sales tax and VAT looks like. If you're in Britain, I think the VAT rate is around 15% or 20%. In Norway, it's 25%. And Norway has the biggest natural sovereign wealth fund in the world, and their VAT is 25%. If you go to Jamaica, you're going to be paying, I think, now 16.5%. You go to Barbados, you're paying, I think, now 18% or 17.5%. Belize, as I mentioned, is 12.5%. So, and on top of that, their citizens have to pay income tax. Now, again, I only use that to point out that for as much as we think that we're taxed here, comparatively speaking, we are a low-tax jurisdiction. Because other places, people have to pay a higher VAT and still have to pay income tax. That's the only point I was making on that. Now, I don't want to have to pay VAT either. I get it. So I understand the sentiment that we would like to be able to not have to pay. But for the country to function, this is all the house we live in. And then you live in a house, you have to contribute to the house. So that's the nature of how a tax system works. And there's no getting around that. As far as the advocacy is concerned, I make the point again that I have personally witnessed very effective advocacy that doesn't necessarily involve embarrassing the government. I'm saying if you want something done, and this is not to say that those who wish to politically activate in that way shouldn't do so. This is where democracy, people should do whatever they feel is within the law to do, right? But I'm saying other than embarrassing the government, there are effective ways to get your point across and to make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only point, is that
the difference between productivity
right.
and busyness.
Yeah, and busyness, exactly what we were talking about before the show.
Yeah.
So if there are examples of where you can organize, and I say this with no fear of contradiction, I can at least speak to several administrations, including the current one, who have been receptive to advocacy brought to them by people who are prepared to organize themselves to get something done. So, again, everything ain't burning down. There are effective ways to make things happen. A lot of it, we have to agitate for, you know, the government to do things differently, for civil society, the private sector to do things differently.
So what's the smoke in our eyes then? Is there a forest, a fire, something to fall off?
No, it's that we're focusing on what the others need to do, and that's necessary. But I want us to pay attention to how we can change the way we engage our government and our private sector to make these things happen. Because we all want these things to change. So the question is how, and that's part of the conversation that needs to happen, because part of it is us changing the way we engage to get these things done.
I like this conversation. Let me take this next telephone call and then go to a break. Caller on the line, go ahead. Go ahead, caller. Next call. Caller on the line with us live, go ahead.
Hey, good day. How you doing, Mr. Brad?
Hey, all is well.
And good day to you again.
All right, good day, sir.
I got two questions, and I'm so glad to hear from you. I haven't called for a while when you was on the radio. But anyhow, let's get right to it. Now, you always get speaking about the VAT, right? Mm-hmm. And I always was wondering why we get charged three times. So that's almost like 45. So now it's 12%, so that's like 36%.
Yeah.
So, because when you pay, say if you bring in a car,
right?
They charge you VAT on that,
right?
Then they add up the freight and the other stuff, and then that's VAT on that too, mm-hmm. right? But I seem to remember it's always like seem to be like three VAT on the same product,
right?
Right. So I was wondering why they never correct that. Like why you just don't tally up everything and just charge me 112% on that? Like why was And I keep making noise about it, but it looks like it's like that. That's how it is. But it's still like I feel like I'd be in charge three times. I know. I get you.
Listen, if that's the one question
I'm gonna let him answer. Thanks, man.
The most since I became the FS 4 years ago. Why is VAT compounded? Why do you have to pay VAT on top of all the other taxes and everything else? That's the question. Because the VAT is assessed on the total value of a product. And the total value includes any other taxes that may be imposed or fees. So if you look at something like, you say he comes in. When you bring it in the car, you pay in the VAT on the shipment. That's one discrete service. When there's a delivery fee, the delivery fee isn't part of the bringing the thing in. That's
the towing charge.
It's a totally different charge, so there's a VAT element to that.
Yeah.
If there are another taxes levied that add to the value of it, there's VAT on that. You can make the argument that you don't like that kind of tax, but that's how VAT works here and around the world. It's on the total value of every component of the good or service. What I've told a lot of small businesses, though, because even though this has been said from day one, and a lot of them don't appreciate, is even if you are not at the $100,000 a year threshold, if you have a business and you become a VAT registrant, and if you charge VAT, you can credit back the VAT that you pay in. So a lot of businesses have realized that, listen, if any VAT I pay out on my business expense, I can now reclaim. And but I have to now start charging VAT myself. But for businesses who want to streamline their expenses, that's a way to do so by becoming a VAT registrant and starting charging VAT yourself. All your legitimate business charges, you'll be able to claim any VAT you pay out on that.
So I just want to know this before I go to a commercial break. You're not charged VAT on. So what he's talking about is your subtotals, okay? Right. So in every inflection, at every particular point, one, you got to be able to get your paperwork, you got to pay for the tow truck, and so forth and so on. There's a VAT associated with that. Two, for clearing, for inspection, for
there's you to a VAT be able associated to, with that.
So essentially, you're only paying one VAT, is the grand total.
Yeah, the grand total.
If you look at it.
Yeah, exactly. But it's important for people to understand that at every component, wherever there is a value added, wherever there is a fee or a charge, all of those things are subject to VAT. That's why when you pull out your money or the ATM and they charge you a dollar, that's why it's just 10 cents on top of that, because the dollar is the service fee. So VAT is charged on that. Like I said, I'm not going to debate people as to whether they think that's a good idea or a bad idea, but I want folks to know that that's how the tax works. So if we want a different kind of tax, then we have to come up with something else other than VAT.
Yeah.
If you don't like that element.
Well, guys, we're still here being able to chop it down. I see you guys, telephone calls. You got to let me take this commercial break. We're going to take this quick commercial break and get right back here talking a little bit about finances right here with none other than Marla Johnson. Quick break. Be right back.
Foundation. Great news. Ron's Electric Motors' new location on Cowpen Road, right next to Island Luck, is open Saturdays and Sundays. So for those needing repairs on electric motors, generators, welding machines, water pumps, battery chargers, electric lifts, transformers, and power tools, Ron's Cowpen Road location can have you up and running on weekends. Don't forget, you can still visit Ron's Electric Motors on Wolf Road and Claridge Road, and now Ron's new location on Cowpen Road. Dial 356-0249 or 323-5267.
Tired of banks forcing you to use technology to bank the way they want you to? Your convenience is important. So no matter what your banking needs, Commonwealth Bank's friendly staff are always available in branch for that personal one-on-one service. But when you choose technology, our online and mobile banking app offers you state-of-the-art functionality. The choice is yours. Commonwealth Bank. Bank the way you want.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Foundation. Foundation. The foundation. Foundation.
And we are back, ladies and gentlemen, 96.9 FM radio. Howard Grant in your company. The foundation lines are wide open. 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. Anywhere for the family of islands. 242-5720. Hit me up, 422-4796. We're here talking with none other than Marlon Johnson. Just being able to put a few things to the table today. Now, I want to talk to you about this now. I see your calls on the line. Don't fight me. I won't put this on the table. I got to talk about this. The government of the Bahamas has spent $60 million, I think, about 10 years ago. Was it 2014? 10 years ago for the acquisition, the purchase of the Grand Lucayan Hotel in Grand Bahama, right? Since then, they have done absolutely nothing with it, right? Okay. The prospect, they have gone between administrations, being able to identify far and wide persons who will be able to kind of collect and purchase this asset. That hasn't happened. A few weeks back, we just started to have this kind of a discussion when the Prime Minister came to the forefront and said that he's hopeful, right? He's hopeful that this year that we can be able to take care of that. And I was indifferent with this kind of a hope prospect. Right. And, someone called in and saying, well, what do you think we should do with it? In my naive state, as a business person who looks at opportunities to be able to empower the Bahamian people, I said, I don't think the government should sell that asset. I don't. I think the government should create the public-private partnership and opportunities, whether or not you give this entity to some grouping that can be able to identify the equity value of it, right? So they say, okay, this is the equity value of this particular thing. They do a proper assessment. They say, okay, it's worth no longer $60 million, it's worth $30 million, right? And then you talk to some bigwig socially. These are names I called on society.
Right.
Not that these are the people that we're thinking of. But we know at the forefront, from a financial standpoint, we know Sabas, we know Adrian Fox, we know Craig Flowers, right? And then just for conversation purposes, I said, give them an equity share value of 15% each. Mm-hmm. And then the government of the Bahamas acquires another 15%, right? That's 60%. Take 10%, identify leadership throughout the length and breadth of the property, slice this up into leadership and give them equity value, making them owners, and take 30% and sell it amongst the Bahamian people.
Right.
Talk to me about this concept and idea of crowdfunding, public-private partnership, and how this could really work to see the country move forward.
So we need all of that. I'll take them in discrete steps. Let's set aside the PPP and the crowdfunding and look at your example specifically. I think the challenge that you would have just with that example is the peculiar nature of Grand Bahama where it sits right now. My advice, if someone would ask me and nobody has, would be to try to find, if you want to sell that property, you sell to somebody with deep pockets who can bring their own people. And that's only because of the peculiar situation in Grand Bahama.
This heavy, what you're saying.
And because you that entity, and given the size of the Grand Lucayan, and assuming they get, Breakers Reef, I think that's what it's called, the large.
Breakers Point.
Yeah. They get that back up and operational. To keep that full, you need people who could bring their own people because that would be the catalyst for the start of the Grand Bahama property. And that's why an Atlantis was so important. And Saul Kirzner, because he had the heft and he had the experience and he had the sort of market cachet to be able to bring it in. So we need, in my view, to get a big play in there because it's Grand Bahama. If it was New Providence, I would feel a lot more comfortable with your approach because New Providence doesn't have the airlift. New Providence already sort of a destination and it's defined and the like. And so I think you could sort of exercise a little bit more flexibility there. And then when you identify the behaving partners, you will have to, because resorts are a difficult business. We you know, our own country and many others are littered with people who bought resorts and they sell them in 5-6 years or whatnot, because it's feast and famine. When things are good, you make a lot of money, but when things slow down, they are extremely cost intensive to run. So you really need people who have deep pockets and long views and who have the interest. So if you're going to identify Bahamians of means who are going to invest in it, they have to really be prepared to stay the long haul and make it work. And I think that's been part of the challenge. The people who are moneyed interest in the country have made money either through just merchant trade, or in the case of sort of the gaming house operators and the like. And then, so they're in very specific niches. I don't know how interested they are in that side of it, because you're going to need an owner who's really going to be dedicated to see it through. But there's good news, though, Howard. And that's the vacation home rental market. So if I was a Bahamian, I am a Bahamian. So as a Bahamian, I think that those platforms can allow for us to get into significant hotel properties or hospitality properties without us having to go through the infrastructure that you would typically need. What we would then have to ask of the government is to make sure follow through on the upgrades to the airports, docks, marinas in the Family Islands that can turn into a thriving Airbnb kind of hospitality arena that's low impact, and that where ownership would be spread far and wide.
We've been having conversations about Grand Bahama for a very long time and the concepts of what can happen in those areas. Now, we know that Hutchinson Whampoa has significant interest, and they own the ports, essentially, in Grand Bahama, doing a great deal of things like that. A lot of persons are indifferent with being able to see these assets being given out to these major companies externally, right? Mm-hmm. And simultaneously, locally, we've been having conversation about financial empowerment of the Bahamian people. Right. We've been talking about NIB. We've been talking about this kind of a concept and idea as to whether or not there is a space available in 15 years, 20 years for all of us who's paying NIB now. Will we have anything in due time and due season? Right. There's been these kind of conversations. Right. So the concept of why I even approach this, because these were just hypothetical
names. Right, I understand,
right. The concept of why we approach this and had a conversation like this is creating a 401k of sorts, that persons who are investing in it in due time and due season can be able to reap the rewards, but not necessarily being able to lean heavily on state-owned enterprises and government entities, so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. So there was an idea of how do we empower ourselves without this kind of an expectation of the government providing opportunities like this.
So, no, your thinking is extremely sound. The way that I would suggest it is something called a REIT, a real estate investment trust. And again, Bahamians have talked about this in various forms. And that, if collectively, you can have small investments that can create a pool of money that can be then invested in real estate. You do not typically want to use your national insurance funds and stuff like that, because that's funding, you know, people's old senior retirement, and so those have to be in very stable, secure elements, because if you do speculative investments in it, if it goes south, then the people's money won't be there. So NIB wouldn't be the right source for that, but the thinking is sound. And it gets me back to the point we were talking about earlier, is how do we mobilize collective action to move away from just talk into things that are viable? Because There are 200,000 adult Bahamians are there, about probably a little bit more than that. And I imagine if you really canvass side, you could find 10,000. Let's just call it that. 10,000 people.
5%
interested. If 10,000 people put up $1,000, that's $10 million. Right? And I'm pretty certain you could find 10,000 people who could find $1,000. Or 20,000 who could find 500.
They just got willing to participate now.
It's a willingness
to get over this kind of a hump and fair.
Right. So if you have $10 million cash now and we want to
go to cash.
Yeah, that's just cash. And you say you want to go to the government to leverage that.
We won't buy this.
Yeah, we want you, the government, not to give us a crown land, but to come in as a co-investor with us, with your crown land. And we will then take our $10 million, leave it in treasury bills or some other government interest, and borrow against that. So we still hold on our cash. We borrow against that with $10 million in cash. If all goes well, if it goes to hell, they liquidate our $10 million in cash. But if it does good, we still have the $10 million in cash.
We lose $1,000.
Yeah, exactly. So now you will buy $10 million worth of property. So now you got $20 million in assets. And now you can start to leverage that to put up the
We got to have more condos, conversations like this.
And get it going.
But we got to have more conversations
like this. The point making is that instead of us claiming, I don't have $1 million to do it, that is true. Collectively, though, we have more than $1 million.
This is the chief in Indian concept. Yeah, everyone, from a cultural standpoint, seeks to be the chief.
And I don't trust you, and I don't trust...
You're all a thief.
So again, but part of the things we have to understand culturally is, even if you trust somebody, you don't know if that person is going... That person may get a stroke, and all of a sudden, their significant other takes it over.
My God.
And you don't trust them. So what you do is you reduce it to paper. You can't... We're too casual. I give somebody $1,000 to go get a car... apart from me. You have anything in writing? You have anything in WhatsApp? No. So until we understand that there's some effort, I may trust you, Howard, but if we get into business, it has to be documented. It has to be some legal recourse I could have to hold this account. So,
my God.
So let's move past this.
I can't trust you, fellas, with churn. As soon as they sneeze, you got to use my money. You need to stop. Let's take a telephone call. Yeah. Okay. Quick telephone call. Call on the line with this live. Go ahead.
Hello, Howard.
Hey.
Yeah, good afternoon to you, and good afternoon, Mr. Johnson.
Good afternoon. What's
happening? Yeah, Howard, I'm calling from after the 1 o'clock news break. My cell phone freeze. As soon as I get back in, I call back in, you go on to commercial, you come back on commercial, that's the next 20 minutes you're talking. Anyway, let me get this in, man. Mr. Johnson,
yes, sir.
I disagree with you when you say with the Freedom of Information Act, that us, the Bahamian people, have let them get away with it. I disagree with that because if you notice, the government changed 7 times.
Mm-hmm.
Every 5 years, 7 times. So the Bahamian people does hold that to their feet that they want local government for New Providence and they want the Freedom of Information Act, but they just don't do it. So the Bahamian people just vote them out. The next thing I disagree with you about, getting your funds, get your business plan together and go to the government, and they should have no problem with that. I give you two names, Toby Smith and Al Golly. Toby Smith and Al Golly. Yeah, they had their business proposals together and the government reject that. And then another thing is, with taxes, with paying the VAT and paying taxes. See, I hear y'all talking about the states and Biden. Even when I go over in the states in the malls or something, I don't mind paying taxes on whatever I buy. Anything. Look at their roads, look at their hospitals, look at their clothes. See, the Bahamian people, we don't mind paying the taxes, you know, once we get value for our money. Because, like, I have two cars. I had one of the cars off the road because I had a power stand problem. But time as I get it back on the road, I go and license it. They tell me I had to pay for 2 years. I pay $400. But look at these roads. Look at these roads that we have around here. Look at these stoplights. Look at these street lights. You see, we don't mind getting... We can pay the taxes if we get the money, value for the money. And that's the last thing. I got going on this one. Your former boss, the Minister of Finance, the Honorable Dr. Hubert Minnis, said that the government and the country loses $500 million a year. $500 million a year on corruption.
Yeah.
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 Don't you think if we clock up some of that, if we could just get $300 million, I see Prime Minister Davis talking about the cigarettes, the tobacco, the liquor smuggling, and them type of things.
Yeah.
But if you and some of that would be on the politicians too. Because you know we had 5 MPs before the courts in the last 6 years. So if you don't think if we clock up some of that, that could help go towards the deficit, to get the deficit down and stop putting all the burden on the Bahamian people. I hang up and listen. Howard, Marlon Johnson say that's what we want, the input from the people, the Bahamian people. So you got to let the Bahamian people get it, answer the phone more, man.
Don't
because I can afford it on a cell phone. I hold for 45 minutes on a cell phone.
Don't
all right, boss.
I appreciate you leaving that because you wait and you held on and you gave great input. You started to talk more specifically about value for money. Despite the fact that we have value-added tax,
right,
there's no reciprocity in terms of value for money.
The way we get to the value of money question, which is a valid point and a valid critique, is that we got to insist collectively that the books be open. We got to know what's going on. We don't know if we're getting value for money because we don't have the insight in the books. It's somebody leaks up and somebody hears something. So the way that we do is, and I don't accept the story that we constantly ask for freedom of information and the things, because if we did, the politicians would be responsive. When I find that people get an opportunity to have audience with their policymakers, they agitate for things that are immediate for them.
Yeah, they want a contract.
They wanted this, they want a job. And again, I don't say you don't do that, but if the politicians are now listening to the, well, you want me to help you out. But if our attention is that, listen, no, what we want is freedom of information or whatnot, they are going to respond because they want to get reelected. So if he's been doing it, let him keep it on. He brought up a point, I think, what he said about the value-added tax. He made a call. He talked about the people who don't get approved. He mentioned two people.
Toby and Al Colley.
But if he goes right on the SBDC website, he can find out the list of hundreds of people who have gotten approved. Not every proposal is going to be approved. So not that because you now do up your proposal and go to the government mean that you're going to get a yes. In nowhere in the world does it work that way. You have to have something that you know, where there's a government, there has to be agreement. The bank has to be prepared to fund it and the like. So, no, nobody, we're not going to bat 1,000. Not everybody who comes with something is going to get approved.
My God.
But there are...
We might bat 85.
Yeah, but yes, again, you could go on the SBDC website. Jesus. And they have a section of the clients funded. You could see the names of ordinary behemoths.
But when you're in that 15% who ain't get it.
Yeah, I know you feel it's the word. So I just made the point that, yeah, he can pull out examples of people who didn't get it, but that doesn't make the case that it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Because you could find people who get it done. And again, I have no challenge with folks disagreeing with me. We need more productive disagreement because we need the dialogue and the discussion to advance things forward. And as long as those are honest disagreements, that's the wonderful thing about a democracy.
Let's take this next telephone call. Caller on the line with us live. Go ahead. Next caller. Caller on the line with us live. Go ahead. You on with us?
Yeah. Hello.
Hey, what's up?
Yeah, good morning.
Sound like Anton.
How you doing, Howard?
Go ahead. Elsewhere, Anton, what's happening with you? I got to give you 1 minute today. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's fine. And good afternoon, the former financial secretary, Mr. Johnson.
Good afternoon.
Howard, like your man, you got to... You tell people on all too long.
Oh, man. Jesus, you're going to fight me today. You know, we got a man talking.
Anyway, Marlon.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Johnson.
Yes, sir.
Look, one of the areas, and I agree with you, that one of the areas the Yemen are taking advantage of getting into tourism is by Airbnb, right?
Right.
However, my concern as a Bahamian and a nationalist is, what has the government done to encourage Bahamians to position Bahamians and to promote Bahamians in large numbers getting into Airbnb? What concessions has been afforded to Bahamians who want to get involved in Airbnb or using it as a means to encourage greater expansion of ownership in the tourism economy?
Mm-hmm.
What tax concessions, what benefits, what relief has the government or has any government offered Bahamians? None. The only thing that we are seeing as it relates to the little window that they open up is a taxation. I have a problem with that.
So
right?
So let me answer your question directly. You can, if you want to form a company for this purpose, and under the previous administration, all concessions that have been given to hotels are now open to every single small Bahamian business owner. Everyone.
Hold on.
I can say it again.
Yes, please repeat that.
Former company.
All businesses can apply now for, if they are opening a business or expanding the business, they can apply for the very same tax concessions that had been given to large businesses.
Yes,
don't say nothing. Hold on. I got 7 minutes here. Let me say this.
Okay.
When I open up my Airbnb on the side house.
No. When you open up your Airbnb on the side of your house, you have to open it up as a business.
Okay, yes, it's a business.
Yeah, it is a business. You have to turn it into a business. It's a difference.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so we go through the formality, but this is only independently. Howard Grant Airbnb, boom.
Right.
One, are you saying to me now I have to identify, call Anton, and form a conglomerate?
No, you have to have a business license. You have to turn it into a business.
And so the concessions that you give major hotels, I could be able to get that importate. I could bring my bed in free.
Yeah, but that's true. All small businesses today. Yes. Now.
No, man. Marlon,
that was not happening. When Dionisio Diagola stood up in the House of Assembly.
Guys, if I say, you could Google it. I can't lie about something. Why would I lie about something like that? Google it.
We can Google it.
I don't need to Google that, Marlon.
So then when you tell me telling them it's true, now come on, let's be fair.
No. I wouldn't go that far as I said. What I would say to you, Marlon, is you are suggesting that you open up a small business, period, any small business.
Yes.
And you can access the exact same benefits that...
This was in the Over the Hill initiative, eh?
No.
That hotels are afforded in this country.
Yes.
By government support.
Yes.
That's what you're suggesting.
Yes.
I'll give him all it. All right. Next point, if I can make.
No. I don't want you to laugh at me disrespectfully because you. No. Come on, guys. No, we adults.
I agree with Marcus.
What I'm doing.
Right, yeah, no, but that's what you just did. You know what you're doing? No. Why are you laughing? What's the joke?
You are misinterpreting my laugh.
What's the laugh?
My laugh is, look here, I can do some research into that, and I can get back to you.
I knew that existed for the Hill entity.
No, guys, let me explain. Yeah. See, a lot of things happen in the country. And, no, let me finish. Let me finish. I was in the chair.
Yes.
And if it wasn't the last budget, it was the second to last budget. The government announced that all small businesses can apply for all the concessions given to any business. So if you have, and it don't have to be in hospitality, if you have a small business, this is a mechanic shop.
Is that it, Marlon?
Yes. You can apply. All small business. Now, what I think where people may get mixed up, if I am doing most people who do an Airbnb don't do it as a business.
As a business, right.
Right. And so that's where you get that sort of a hiccup. If you do it as an extension of your own place.
That's the best kept secret in the country.
No, but it ain't a secret. No. Because it's open to all businesses. You can apply for it straight through the administration.
Why was you having this conversation? And I got to let you go. Anton. I only got 3 minutes left. Why was you having this conversation? Now, there is a refresher in my mind that the former administration, Dr. Minnis, created this concept that existed in the Overhill, and then he created elements and phases to expand this throughout. Is this the same expansion, or this is something entirely different?
Two things happened. The former administration and the current administration has kept it. There are special economic zones in the less developed family islands where you can get tax concessions to build stuff or whatever. That was sort of an extension of the Overhill. Separate from that, the government made a determination that small businesses who are building or expanding their business can apply for tax concessions for the things that they need for their business.
Including duty-free vehicles, including
things. It's online. You can do a quick Google and you'll find it. Bahama Small Business Incentives. Or it's right there.
Okay.
And that's been in place, I think, either from 2020 or 2021. I don't remember the specific year.
Last caller. Don't cuss me. You got 30 seconds. Go ahead. Caller on the line. Go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Grant. How are you, sir?
Fantastic. How are you doing?
Great, Father. Thank you that finally I'm on. And thank you. And hello to your guest. Mr. Grant, let me tell you.
Yes, ma'am.
Our leaders, our politicians, our lawmakers, and the government, they have been getting over on the Bahamian people. Do you know that they are passing bills in the House of Assembly, like value-added tax, without passing it in the Senate, which makes it illegal, sir, from 2015? I have been trying to get the cabinet, the House of Assembly, also Mr. Marlon Johnson, when he was in the chair, to please have also the Minister of Finance produce in the House of Assembly where VAT was lawfully passed in the Senate, sir, and also when the date was appointed for its enactment.
Okay, I can get that information.
I need you, sir, as a talk show host also,
yes,
to
ma'am.
Please investigate it. They have defrauded the people of almost $13 billion. Please investigate.
Okay. I appreciate your telephone call. Thank you so very kindly for holding. We're going to look into that. It doesn't seem like it lines up with what's happening.
You can check if you're interested is government publications and ask for the gazetted versions of the VAT legislation. I would be very surprised if it were found out that
This was a major position.
Yeah, it was a major legislation. So the process is it goes to the House, it then goes to the
Senate. They went to select committee, they went to everything. They had everything set up before they even introduced this concept.
It goes to the Senate, it goes to the Governor General for assent, and then there's an appointment day notice done. So, again, I can't say that isn't the case, but I would be very surprised if that is so.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the show today, Marlon. I want to thank you so very kindly, man. You and I are going to have deeper, further conversations about being able to have this at least once a month or some kind of way that we can have interactions of persons of being able to find out a little bit more. This will be our form and our avenue of being able to bring financial literacy to our people with real-time issues, with real things that concern the people, and being able to bring that. I'd love to see that on the foundation to be able to do that. And now that we are on this sort of a vacation before you get back in office, I don't know whether or not you've been solicited. Talk to me.
I'm an independent consultant right now.
I like this.
I'm staying busy. because they've been very, very, very fortunate person. I can't complain. Yeah.
Okay, so before you get solicited again for those persons who try to be able to construct their stuff, we want to be able to do something to engage the Bahamian people and find a way that they can be able to, with things that matter to them, real things, to talk about this stuff. I want to thank you so much, my brother, for being able to sit with us today. Thank you so very kindly for that. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the show today. I want to thank you so kindly for tuning in right here on The Foundation. Tomorrow, we're going to chop this thing down a little bit more, talk about crime. Two persons, somebody texts me and says, Howard, being snuffed out is not a word to be able to say as a professional journalist. Well, forgive me. Persons have been excommunicated. These persons have been taken out, outside of their will. And we're going to be able to talk about that, the murders that persist in our society, and how we can be able to find ourselves, the same way we need to contribute to our position from an economic standpoint, find ourselves in a position to find growth and development as it relates to our crime and what's going on in our country. That's the show today. We have a great time, guys. Have a beautiful day. We'll see you tomorrow. Godspeed, right here on The Foundation with Howard Grant.